All right, welcome you right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, Texas. We're going to be diving deep today into something that I think impacts our lives every single day, and that is how our communities are built and how you as a resident can play a bigger role in shaping our local landscape.
Right. And I think when we look at this, big picture of housing and community development, sometimes it feels like these are challenges that are so big, it's hard to imagine how we can have an impact on our own.
Exactly. And so that's why we're focusing on a recent conversation from the Strong Towns podcast featuring Chuck Marone and Seth Zarin.
Okay.
Seth is what's called an incremental developer
Okay.
from Providence, Rhode Island.
Interesting.
Now, Providence might seem quite different from our corner of Texas.
It is geographically distant, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But, I think a lot of times the core questions that communities face when trying to become strong and vibrant neighborhoods, particularly when it comes to housing,
Yeah.
often have surprising parallels no matter where you are.
Exactly. And so our mission in this deep dive is to extract the most valuable insights from their discussion, particularly around how to make it simpler to build diverse and affordable housing on a local level.
Okay.
And then really think about how these ideas could apply right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Makes sense.
Now, I think one of the things that's fascinating right from the start is how Chuck Marone acknowledges the enormity of the housing issue.
Yeah.
He talks about how it's such a big problem and it can feel so overwhelming.
You can feel like this, intractable problem with no easy answers.
Right.
But I like how quickly he and Seth bring it back to the need for local ground level solutions.
Okay, so let's kind of unpack a little bit some
Yeah.
of these potential solutions.
Okay.
So Chuck mentions that Strong Towns has been trying to simplify this down into three core concepts for local action,
Okay.
and that is number one, fixing the regulatory process.
Okay.
Number two, supporting what they call incremental developers.
Okay.
And then number three, figuring out how to finance entry-level housing.
Right.
And even just those three broad strokes sound like a lot.
They do, and that's why they're developing more focused toolkits to help cities actually make progress in these areas.
Right.
And the one we'll talk about today is their toolkit designed to simply make building more housing easier.
Right. And it's interesting because Chuck references back to a previous discussion they had about an article that Seth had written.
Okay.
And they didn't necessarily agree with each other completely. It was kind of a friendly debate.
Right. I think it was a respectful disagreement.
Yeah.
But, I really like Seth's perspective on this disagreement.
Yeah.
He talks about the fundamental importance of debate.
Yeah.
If everyone always agrees, if everyone always nods their heads, then ideas aren't really being rigorously tested.
Right.
You end up with these kind of unchallenged assumptions or just, repeating the same notions.
You're just in an echo chamber.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Seth makes the really interesting point that engaging in debate, even disagreeing, actually strengthens his arguments.
It makes him sharper.
Exactly, because he has to grapple with different perspectives and refine his thinking.
You know, that idea that constructive friction can lead to better outcomes.
That's right.
So, connecting this to our focus here with think and act locally.
Yeah.
Think about the conversations that are happening in your own neighborhood,
Right, the nearing commuter.
at city council meetings within your homeowners association, or even just chatting with neighbors over the fence.
Or even online in community forums.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Diverse viewpoints and a willingness to discuss ideas respectfully. I think these are so essential for finding the best and most effective local solutions.
I completely agree with you.
Okay, so then Chuck kind of shifts gears a little bit
Okay.
and asks Seth about his kind of everyday work as an incremental developer.
Okay.
Because, in order to really understand this idea of incremental development, it helps to really get to know Seth a little bit.
Okay.
So he describes himself as a neighborhood real estate developer based in Providence, Rhode Island. He's been doing this for about 10 years. And interestingly, he didn't come from a family involved in real estate.
Interesting. So he's kind of an outsider.
Yeah, he describes it as worming his way in, starting with an apprenticeship in Boston before finding Providence a little bit more affordable.
I see.
And so in Providence, he joined this company called Armory Management Company,
Okay.
where he's now a partner. And what's interesting about Armory Management Company is their focus is very localized,
Oh.
primarily working in a few neighborhoods where most of their team actually lives.
Interesting.
They're a full service company, they manage both residential and commercial properties. They handle their own maintenance and construction, and of course, they undertake development projects.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they kind of do it all.
They do it all. Their projects range from managing hundreds of apartments and a significant amount of commercial space to more targeted infill and adaptive reuse projects.
Okay.
He gives a fascinating example of converting an 1850s townhouse, which had later been used as office space, back into four residential apartments.
Wow, talk about uncovering the past.
I know, right? And during that project, they discovered an 1892 newspaper tucked away under the floorboards.
That's amazing.
It's such a great detail, and it really brings their work to life, and it reminds us of the history embedded in our built environment.
Yeah, it does. And it highlights the idea that they're working within the existing fabric of the city,
Right.
often with these older buildings that have their own stories to tell.
Right. They also take on larger commercial mill renovations and even some ground-up multifamily construction.
Okay.
But I think what really stood out to me was Seth's philosophy of development that's centered on the neighborhood.
Interesting.
He emphasizes that the long-term value lies not just in the individual building,
Yeah.
but in making the entire neighborhood stronger.
I see.
So things like planting street trees, improving sidewalks, even being selective about commercial tenants.
Right. So it's about more than just the buildings themselves.
Exactly. It's this long-term vision for community well-being.
And that really challenges, I think, the common image that people have of developers.
Yeah.
You know, often they're seen as focused solely on short-term profits
Stereotype, yeah.
without much consideration for the broader community.
Yeah.
But Seth's approach seems much more integrated
Right.
and focused on creating sustained value.
Exactly. And Chuck kind of brings that up directly. He says, you know, there's this common misperception about developers, like
Yeah.
that they're all incredibly wealthy and, you know, just effortlessly making money.
Right. You know, the stereotype of the, you know, the developer driving around in a fancy car.
Yeah,
You know,
exactly.
just, you know, kind of raking in the dough.
Right. And Seth kind of challenges this. He jokes that, you know, his wife often wonders where all the money is
Right.
and, you know, points out that any profits are constantly being reinvested in their
Right.
properties.
And he actually lives in a three-family house that he and his wife purchased,
Okay.
where they reside on the second floor with tenants above and below. Yeah. So it's a good reminder that, you know, the reality on the ground can be quite
Yeah.
different
Right.
from the, you know, kind of popular caricature.
From the stereotype. Yeah. And Chuck makes this really, I think, crucial point that being a developer is actually a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And the profit margins can be surprisingly thin.
Yeah, it's not always as glamorous or as lucrative as it's often portrayed.
Right.
And then they make this really interesting point
Yeah.
that developers are often the last ones to get paid.
Really?
So everyone else involved in the project, the banks providing financing, the contractors doing the construction, the architects designing the plans,
They all get paid first.
they all get paid first. And then
Yeah.
if there's money remaining, the developer might do well.
Yeah.
But there's also, you know, a significant risk of not getting paid at all or even having to cover unexpected costs themselves.
So then Chuck brings up this really thought-provoking idea, and I think it's so important for what we're trying to do here at Think and Act locally. And that is this idea of a chasm in the US between those who build our cities and those of us who use them.
Yeah.
He contrasts this with historical norms and what's still prevalent in many parts of the world, where building was much more integrated into the community, often done by neighbors or family members.
Right.
So, you know, thinking about Think and Act locally, how do we bridge that gap here at home?
Right. Because, you know, this disconnect where most people just buy or rent homes or use buildings produced by others
Right.
oftentimes means there isn't a, you know, direct understanding of or interaction
With that
with that
process.
complex process of city building.
Right. Okay. So now Seth is very clear that their company operates as a for-profit business.
Okay.
They aim to make money, they provide returns for their investors,
Right.
but he kind of reframes this idea of profit not as something that's inherently exploitative, but as a necessary mechanism
Right.
for accumulating capital, which then enables future building and reinvestment in the community.
I see. So it's not so much about just making money, but about using that money to do more.
To build more to improve the community.
Exactly. And he says, you know, this notion that development can just happen without profit
Right.
doesn't really make sense
Yeah.
because you need that capital.
You need that initial capital to even get started.
Exactly. And he points out that investors, you know, they could just as easily put their money in something that's considered less risky,
Yeah.
like municipal bonds.
Right.
And so, you know, real estate development needs to offer a competitive return
Yeah.
to attract that investment,
Yeah.
particularly when you consider the inherent risks and the less liquid nature of real estate.
So there has to be some incentive for people to want to put their money into this.
Right. And then Seth makes this point that I think is really important for us to remember.
What's that?
And that is that there's a huge diversity within the field of real estate development.
Okay.
It's not this single uniform entity.
So it's not just one type of person doing this.
Right. You have everything from individuals flipping houses to large corporations undertaking massive commercial projects. Okay.
And the experiences and the resources of those involved can vary dramatically.
That makes sense.
He even shares a personal example. He mentions that he drives a Honda HR-V and uses an electric cargo bike.
So not exactly the stereotypical image of a developer.
Exactly right. And so, you know, this really underscores that a wide range of people with different backgrounds and resources are involved in this work.
Makes sense.
All right. So this brings us to the heart of their discussion.
Okay.
And that is what Chuck calls the Housing Ready City Toolkit.
Right.
So Chuck explains that through their travels and conversations about housing challenges, they identified these common policy elements that cities could adopt to make building easier and more affordable.
Interesting.
And they've distilled it down to six key policies.
Okay, let's hear it.
So policy number one.
Yeah.
Allowing single-family homes to be converted into duplexes or triplexes by right.
By right.
By right. And so I want to ask you, for you listening in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena, what does by right mean?
So by right essentially means that if you meet the basic zoning regulations, you don't have to go through this lengthy and often unpredictable discretionary approval process.
So you don't have to go and ask for permission.
Exactly.
Okay.
And this allows for what's often called gentle density.
Gentle density.
In existing neighborhoods.
Oh, okay.
So basically, it's a way of gradually increasing the number of housing units without drastically altering the look and feel of the area.
I see.
So you can imagine more options for families or individuals to live in these established neighborhoods without having to construct large new buildings.
Okay, so policy number two builds on this idea.
Yep.
Allowing backyard cottages.
Backyard cottages.
Also known as accessory dwelling units or ADUs.
Okay, I've heard of those.
In all residential zones.
Okay.
So for homeowners in our community that have extra space in their yards,
this
could present some interesting possibilities.
It could.
Now, Seth is particularly enthusiastic about ADUs. He points to California's experience where making it easier to build ADUs actually engaged a different segment of the construction market.
Interesting.
The flipper.
The flipper.
So people who are already buying and renovating homes found that adding an ADU was a viable way to increase housing options.
I see.
And again, this goes right back to our Think and Act Locally focus.
Right.
Utilizing the existing resources within our neighborhoods to create more housing.
It's about leveraging that existing activity and the people that are already working on homes.
Right. And Seth makes this really interesting point.
What's that?
That, you know, so much of what city zoning does is it regulates the use of land.
Right.
And he asks the question, if a house looks the same from the outside, why should it matter if one, two, or three families live inside?
It's a good question.
Right.
It really challenges, I think, the historical basis of single-family zoning.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as they discussed, has roots in these now outdated social ideas about family structures and who should reside in certain areas.
Right.
And Seth rightly points out that multifamily living is not some historical anomaly.
Right.
The post-World War II dominance of single-family zoning is actually the outlier.
Right. And if you think about our own neighborhoods, especially the ones that were developed earlier, you see much more of a mix of housing types.
That's right. And I think when you talk about what feels normal, it can be more acceptable to people.
Right.
And Seth makes this great point that framing these changes as restoring a more traditional way of building rather than some radical new concept can be much more persuasive in local discussions.
And then he emphasizes that allowing these internal conversions and ADUs is often the most cost-effective way to add housing units because you're working with existing infrastructure.
That's right.
You know, you're not having to build new streets. You're not having to build new, you know, sewer lines and things like that.
Right. And while building codes will still apply to ensure safety.
Of course.
You're not starting from scratch with foundations and entirely new structures.
Right. Now, Chuck raises this interesting question about potentially taking spare bedrooms in existing single-family homes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, adding kitchenettes and things like that.
Yeah.
To create more like efficiency apartments, you know, given that a large percentage of households today are just one or two people.
Yeah.
It seems like a logical way to better utilize existing space.
So what does Seth say about that?
So Seth is cautiously optimistic about this idea.
Okay.
He says, you know, there's a lot of potential there with underutilized space.
Yeah.
But he points out some practical challenges related to the layout of houses.
Okay.
Where bedrooms are often upstairs, making separate entrances difficult.
Okay.
And then he brings up this huge hurdle, which is building codes.
Right.
Which often require specific fire safety measures.
Yeah.
Like a 1-hour fire separation between dwelling units. And that can be hard to achieve.
In existing structures without significant renovation.
Right. And that 1-hour fire separation is there to give occupants, you know, enough time to safely escape.
Right. To contain a fire potentially.
Yeah, exactly.
To give firefighters time to get there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So while the concept has merit,
yeah,
there are definitely regulatory hurdles to consider.
There are.
But Seth does agree with the importance of setting ambitious goals at the municipal level.
Okay.
Because, you know, it gives our community something to strive for.
Right. It gives us a benchmark against which we can measure progress.
Exactly.
And then Seth also touches on the fact that, you know, while household sizes are generally decreasing,
yeah,
you know, there's still a lot of people who want more space.
Right.
So, you know, just focusing on smaller units may not be the only answer.
Right. It's not one size fits all.
Exactly. Location and, you know, specific characteristics of a property also play a role in what kind of housing is desirable in a particular area.
So policy number three in the toolkit.
Okay. Number three.
Legalize starter homes in all residential zones.
Starter homes.
Yeah. So they define starter homes as smaller houses that are built with the potential for future expansion.
Okay.
And Chuck specifically wants to move away from the term tiny house.
Interesting. Why is that?
Because he feels like tiny house sometimes carries this connotation that doesn't really align with the goal of broadly increasing affordable housing options.
I see.
And Seth agrees. He says, you know, the tiny house movement is interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not likely to be the primary solution for addressing housing affordability on a large scale in our community.
I see.
And so he reinforces this idea that starter homes are often smaller initially.
Yeah.
But designed with the possibility of adding on rooms or expanding over time.
Right. So it reflects a more natural pattern of growth.
Exactly.
As a family's needs change.
Right.
Which I guess is the opposite of that current trend of often building the largest house you could afford right away.
Right. It's kind of the opposite of that McMansion phenomenon where people try to replicate the look of a house.
Yeah.
That has evolved over decades.
Yeah.
All at once.
Yeah.
With often results that don't quite feel right.
Yeah, I've definitely seen some of those.
Yeah, and Seth mentions that while the term starter home has faced some criticism,
okay,
the core principle of removing minimum house size requirements,
yeah,
makes a lot of sense in many regions, especially where there's room for outward growth.
I see.
Or in larger infill projects.
Delicious.
Policy number four.
Okay, number four.
Eliminate minimum lot size requirements.
Minimum lot size.
Now, Chuck notes that this is a policy change that often causes concern among city planners and zoning officials.
Maybe. Why is that?
I think there's this feeling that they're losing control over a fundamental aspect of how neighborhoods are shaped.
I see.
But the case for eliminating minimum lot sizes, I think, is particularly strong in areas that are already largely developed.
Okay.
So you often find these older parcels of land that are slightly larger than what current zoning allows for new subdivisions.
I see.
So it essentially prevents any new development.
Interesting.
On these potentially valuable lots.
Okay.
And so think about some of our older neighborhoods here in Deer Park, LaPorte or Pasadena.
Yeah.
That were originally platted with smaller lots, you know, decades ago.
Okay.
If that minimum lot size has been increased since then.
Yeah.
You know, that larger undivided parcel.
Right.
Might no longer meet those current requirements.
Be subdivided into a few smaller, more affordable homes.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And Seth gives a really good example of how, you know, even reverting back to the original slightly smaller lot sizes from a neighborhood's past could significantly increase the number of homes in the area without fundamentally changing its character.
Interesting.
So you'd still largely have single family homes. They'd just be situated on slightly smaller pieces of land.
That makes sense.
And in existing neighborhoods with regularly shaped or slightly undersized lots.
Yeah.
You know, these minimum lot size requirements
right.
can create just arbitrary obstacles
yeah.
to any new construction.
Sure.
And Seth also highlights how smaller lot sizes can make it easier to build smaller, more affordable homes.
Okay.
Including fee simple townhouses.
Fee simple townhouses.
That can be built right next to each other without side setbacks.
And the key here, I think, is the fee simple ownership.
Right.
Meaning you own the land directly.
Right.
Which is different from many condominium arrangements.
Exactly.
And Seth points out that in the U.S., we've largely lost this tradition of building attached homes.
Right.
You know, most new construction tends to be detached single family houses.
Right.
Sitting apart from their neighbors.
Right.
Which is historically and globally actually quite unusual.
Yeah, those small side yards can often end up being underutilized space.
Yeah.
Too narrow to be truly functional.
Right.
But still consuming valuable land.
And those fee simple townhouses being governed by residential building codes.
Right.
Are generally simpler to finance, mm-hmm. less expensive to build, and they make very efficient use of land.
And plus, you know, as Seth says, a lot of people simply want home ownership.
Right. The specific form of the house isn't always the primary concern.
That's right.
And building attached townhouses is a very common and very successful housing model in more densely populated areas around the world.
It is.
So now, you know, some planners might have concerns about potentially, you know, poorly designed subdivisions.
Yeah, I could see that.
And Seth kind of addresses this by saying, you know, look, there might be some initial learning
yeah.
as these new regulations are implemented.
Okay.
But, you know, a system of best practices and better design will naturally evolve over time.
So it's a learning process.
Yeah. And Chuck, being someone who's been involved in regulatory environments for a long time,
yeah.
acknowledges that, yeah, there will be some people who try to do dumb things
All right.
when it comes to subdivision regulations.
But he thinks that the current system often overreacts.
It does, yeah.
Preventing beneficial development without necessarily stopping the poorly conceived projects.
Right. It's kind of a blunt instrument.
And the focus shifts from creating thriving places
to simply enforcing rigid rules.
And Seth kind of echoes this. He says, you know, when the primary focus becomes strict code enforcement,
yeah.
it can stifle innovation and lead to this culture where simply adhering to the letter of the law
yeah.
is prioritized regardless of the actual outcome or the quality of the development.
It's about checking boxes rather than actually creating something good.
Right. And he even jokes that sometimes it feels like things might be better with fewer rules
yeah.
and more, you know, direct communication and agreement
right.
between developers and the local community.
Which, again, really aligns with our think and act locally ethos.
Exactly. All right. Policy number five. This is one that I think generates a lot of discussion.
What's that?
Repeal parking mandates.
Parking mandates.
Chuck comes right out and says, if a city still has mandatory parking requirements,
yeah.
they're likely not truly committed to increasing housing options.
Interesting take. So, Seth, what do you think about this, particularly in places like Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena?
Seth wholeheartedly agrees.
He does.
He points out that a lot of these parking requirements are based on outdated or even completely arbitrary data.
Interesting.
And he recommends a book called The High Cost of Free Parking by Donald Shoup.
I've heard of that one.
Have you?
Yeah, it's a pretty influential work.
It is, and it really exposes this often unfounded nature
yeah.
of these mandates and the negative impact they have.
Okay, so what are the tangible consequences
yeah.
of these parking requirements for our communities?
I mean, the implications are huge.
Okay.
I mean, think about the amount of land that parking consumes.
Yeah.
A single parking space can easily be 300 square feet or more.
Wow.
When you factor in the stall itself and the maneuvering room.
Right. You have to be able to get in and out.
Exactly. And that doesn't even include, you know, the added cost of stormwater management for all that paved impervious surface.
Yeah.
And Seth shares an example from one of their current projects where a parking mandate is creating a major obstacle on an urban infill site.
Even though Providence's zoning ordinance is generally pretty sensible.
Yeah.
This particular infill project on a 10,000 square foot lot
yeah.
can't meet the parking requirement, even if they dedicated the entire ground floor to parking spaces.
Wow.
Which would make the project financially unviable.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're having to pursue a special zoning overlay to eliminate the parking requirement just to allow the project to move forward.
Wow, that's a lot of hoops to jump through.
It is.
So it sounds like in these urban infill situations,
yeah.
parking mandates are often just impossible to satisfy.
They are.
He also makes the argument that on undeveloped land,
yeah.
requiring excessive parking just encourages more suburban sprawl.
Right.
Making it harder to build those more compact, walkable neighborhoods.
Right.
Exactly. Which are often more desirable and more sustainable.
And Seth says, you know, from a developer's standpoint,
yeah,
that, you know, the presence of extensive parking requirements in a city's zoning code,
yeah,
is a huge red flag.
Really?
It signals to them that the city is not really committed to facilitating new construction and increasing housing supply.
I see.
He uses this funny analogy of Van Halen's contract writer.
Oh, yeah.
With the request for no brown M&Ms.
Right.
He says, you know, if you encounter overly strict parking mandates, you know, the city hasn't really thought through the implications for housing and development.
Interesting.
Right. And Chuck brings up this element of fear again.
Yeah.
You know, this worry among zoning officials, residents, and local leaders.
Right.
That if we remove parking mandates,
yeah,
we're going to have these huge parking problems.
All right.
But, you know, as they both point out, you can't legislate against every potential inconvenience.
That's right.
And these mandates often prevent good infill development.
Right.
That could actually revitalize neighborhoods.
Yeah, because, you know, sometimes those parking lots end up being pretty desolate spaces.
They do.
Particularly at night.
Yeah. And Seth makes this crucial observation from a developer standpoint.
What's that?
He says, you know, the current regulatory environment,
yeah,
including restrictive parking mandates,
right,
can unintentionally incentivize less desirable forms of development.
Like what?
Like sprawling strip malls.
Right.
Because those are often more straightforward to navigate under existing rules.
I mean,
and require less creative problem solving and negotiation with the city.
So it's easier to just build the same old thing, right, that we've been building for decades.
Exactly.
Rather than try to do something innovative or different.
Right. Okay, last policy in the toolkit.
Okay, bring it on.
Streamline the approval process.
Okay.
And it seems like everybody generally agrees that this is a good objective.
It's motherhood and apple pie.
Right. But it's often the most challenging to put into practice effectively.
It is.
Now, the Strong Towns Toolkit suggests this ambitious goal of a 24-hour turnaround time for permit approvals.
24-hour?
Assuming a complete application has been submitted.
Oh,
so okay, for those of you listening out there who have ever been involved in any kind of local building or renovation,
yeah,
you know how different the reality often is.
Right. I've heard some horror stories about permit approvals taking months or even years.
Exactly. And so while 24 hours might be a very aspirational target,
yeah,
the underlying principle is absolutely critical.
Right.
And Seth emphasizes that, you know, truly streamlining the approval process,
yeah,
involves much more than just rewriting rules.
So it's not just about changing the laws on the books.
Exactly. It demands attention to efficient management practices, user-friendly software systems,
right,
and a customer-focused organizational culture within the city departments.
So it's about how the city actually operates and how it interacts with people.
Right. And he also clarifies that, you know, zoning approval is a distinct step from obtaining a building permit.
Okay.
And, you know, both of those need to be efficient,
yeah,
to truly facilitate development.
Right.
And he mentions a positive step that's been taken in Rhode Island.
What's that?
Moving all building permit applications to a consistent online portal.
Okay. So kind of centralizing everything and putting it online.
Right.
Which, you know, has led to significant improvements.
Mm.
It's like an organization, communication, and accountability.
And one of the things that online portal does is it provides data,
okay,
on how long it takes to process different types of permits.
So it brings some transparency,
exactly,
into the process.
And that transparency can be so valuable,
yeah,
for identifying bottlenecks,
right,
and areas for improvement within our own city's permitting process.
Makes sense.
And then Seth raises this really fundamental question that I think our local leaders might consider.
What's that?
Are all the existing regulations truly necessary?
It's a good question.
Right. If that review process is consistently lengthy,
yeah,
due to the sheer volume of regulations,
right,